Sometimes we think he brought us to the desert to hurt us, to crush our spirits, to break our hearts, to steal our joy and our dreams, and even maybe to punish us. And it seems like we have to deal with guilt more when we're alone with God in the desert, and that's not comfortable. Seems like we lose something we think is important on every wilderness journey, but the more we seem to lose, the more we seem to love. We learn from the Israelites' wilderness journey that God doesn't take us to the desert to separate us from him, but to love us even more because we begin to understand that he's all in with us. As I realize the truth that God is honestly on my side, then I'm able to let go of more and more because I know, as we just sang about, he is faithful. And I also lay claim to fewer things because he claims me as his own. The desert is a place to let go of the past and be freed for a future defined by Jesus. So this morning I want to do a little backtracking and also some reviewing, and I want us to grab a hold of a few desert lessons we can learn from Israel's experience with God. So let's go back to what started this journey for Israel in Exodus 3. Verse 7, all these texts will be on the screen too. The Lord said, I've indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. God sometimes leads us into places we don't want to go, doesn't he? Desert places. He wants to move the Israelites from slavery to the promised land. There's two simple stages to God's plan. Number one, bring them up out of Egypt. And number two, take them to the land, the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey. And it shouldn't take long. I mean, they leave Egypt, they go across the Sinai Peninsula, and you're there. You know, it's not a long journey. You can make that journey in a couple of weeks. It's just a really short trip. It's like taking I-64 directly to Louisville if, in your wildest imagination, Louisville could be the promised land. That's the stretch there. But as you know, that's not the route God took them on. God leads them in a way they don't expect and they don't want to go. You may remember us talking about the roundabout way of God a few months ago. It's kind of spelled out in Exodus 13. When Pharaoh let the people go, you've had all these plagues, and he's like, okay, I'm through with you, get out of here. God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter, just right across the peninsula. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle. So God took them in a roundabout way. They went to Louisville through Atlanta, and they expected headed east for a not-so-long trip. Imagine their surprise when God's pillar of fire and cloud starts moving south. They're thinking, this pillar is directionally challenged. We're heading to the desert. You know, this doesn't make sense. The Israelite women are especially uptight because they know Moses, being a male, will never consider asking for directions on where they're supposed to go next. And they know there's no promised land down south. There's definitely no milk nor honey down there. God is leading them to the last place they would ever want to go. And this really creates a crisis, a great crisis, in the book of Exodus. Will the people follow God when they don't understand? Will God's people follow him when following doesn't make any sense? Will God's people stay faithful to him in the desert? One of God's qualities that annoys us is this. He doesn't wear a watch. Have you ever noticed that about God? He's never in a hurry. Jesus probably would never order fast food for a number of reasons, but I don't think he would do that. God leads people in the long way around, the way of the desert. And how long will Israel spend in the desert? How long was it? It's 40 years for a journey that could have taken a couple of weeks. The desert is a very important place in the Bible. Many of God's people log a good amount of training in the desert before God sends them on their mission. Moses, before he was kind of anointed as the leader of Israel, spent 40 years in Midian. Elijah runs from Jezebel and straight into the desert for 40 days. After Jesus was baptized, he heads to the desert. After Paul was baptized, he heads to the desert for 3 years. The desert is not a place you want to go. There's not a waiting list to get in. It doesn't flow with milk and honey. I spent 2 years in the desert of West Texas in Abilene. The first 4 months I lived near this place called Lake Fort Phantom. And it was aptly named because it was a phantom lake. There was no water. Where the water should have been, there was only scorpions and tarantulas and rattlesnakes. I remember Mary's response when she saw her first tumbleweed roll across the road of the highway out there in Abilene, and I can say she was not filled with newfound glee. Instead, it was more like, what in the world have you done to this place, and why are we here? You know, why have you brought me here? If you're a follower of Jesus, I guarantee you will find out firsthand the roundabout ways of God in the desert. While you're in the desert, your heart will ache with hurt or maybe loss. You'll be fatigued, and even sleep won't refresh you. You will long for something good, and you know God could so easily grant it, but he chooses not to. And you give him all sorts of solid reasons, and still he doesn't do anything. Maybe a relationship shatters, an engagement ends. Maybe a child you love becomes a prodigal who leaves home and seems to have zero intention of coming back. By the way, God surely understands prodigal children. He's had several in his life over the years. Or you've cherished this dream of yours for years, and you've prayed and you've worked, and you realize it's never going to come true. At these times, faith is hard. It's hard. There's no sense of God's nearness. You're confused, but no answers are coming your way. Your spirit is dry. It's a dry and barren place, and that's what the desert is. Some of you are there right now. And if you are, at least hear this one truth today. God has not forgotten you. You have not been abandoned. Sometimes God leads his children the long way around, but he never, ever forgets them. God accomplishes some amazing things by way of the desert in our hearts. He shapes our souls in the desert. So here are a few lessons we learned from desert training. I got three of them for you this morning. The first one is this: the desert is a place where we learn patience. We learn to follow a God who doesn't wear a watch. The first thought we have when we're in the desert is, when do we get out of here? I mean, that's the first thing you think is, how long is this going to last? When will this end? I don't want to be here. I want out. And here's the danger we face when we look for a quick fix. What did the Israelites do when things got tough? They said, let's go back to where? To Egypt, to slavery. Let's go back to slavery. They even said out loud, we'd rather die than be out here in this desert. The desert is a place we need to learn to follow God one day at a time. So the Israelites do that. They wake up every morning, and there was this cloud. And then the question hits them, do we follow the cloud today? If the cloud sits here today, do we just sit and wait? When we think we know the way to the promised land, do we have the patience to follow God's roundabout way? God teaches Israel this lesson in several ways. In Exodus 16, as a text I think we've read a few times in this series, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, if we had only died by the Lord's hand in Egypt, there we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. Would you say these people are given to any bit of exaggeration? You know, so what does God do? He hears that. What does he do? He provides manna. which means, ironically, what is it? This stuff came on the ground, like, what is it? And so that's what the word manna means. Like, they'd never seen it before. Manna would appear in the morning as the dew dried up, and Moses told them. He told them, only take enough for one day's use. Don't store it up. Don't think about leftovers. Verse 20 of chapter 16, however, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. But they're concerned. You know, I get it. They're anxious. What if there's nothing to eat tomorrow? What if the manna doesn't show up tomorrow? You see, manna has a short shelf life. It comes with an expiration date. It expires today. It's just good for today. So you have to learn God's going to feed you again tomorrow. And when morning comes, God feeds his people again. And when morning comes, God feeds his people again. Day after day and week after week and month after month and year after year, when morning comes, God feeds his people again. Verse 35 of chapter 16, the Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. God was planning for them to learn that he wouldn't forget them. It takes patience to trust God. So maybe after 10 or 15 years of God providing manna every single morning, they might say, you know, maybe tomorrow God will give us manna too. This might happen. Maybe we might not starve to death in this desert after all. The desert is a place where you learn patience and specifically how to wait on God. You may be someone who is listening and you're upset right now about experiencing some desert time in your marriage. You had hopes and dreams, and they haven't come true, and they may never. They may never. The question for you, will you be patient and obedient to God in your marriage? Will you love your husband? Will you love your wife when it's not easy? Sometimes marriage is not easy. It's not easy. I performed a lot of weddings, many in this building. And I always enjoy listening to two people promise to love each other for a lifetime through whatever difficulties may hit. And couples have worded that in a myriad of ways, you know, but it's the same promise. And as I listen to young love speak these covenants, my thought typically is, you have no idea what you're in for. And it's probably good, or you wouldn't be promising these things. You might not say these words because marriage is hard. It's hard, and many of you know about that. I read this story some time ago, which I think you'll enjoy. There was this older couple laying in bed. I mean, they'd been married a long time, 50, 60 years. And the wife said, you know, when we were first married, you used to hold my hand when we laid in bed. Why don't you do that anymore? There's this long pause because his hand-holding apparatus isn't as strong as it once was. But his hand finally reaches out and clutches onto hers, and she's just not satisfied, though. She says, you know, when we first got married, we used to snuggle up right next to me in bed. And there's another long pause because the snuggling apparatus isn't as active as it used to be. Finally, he rolls over, and he kind of crinkly snuggles up next to her, but she's still not satisfied. And she says, you know, when we were first married, you used to nibble on my ear. And he flings the covers back and gets out of bed, and she's hurt. She goes, what are you doing? He goes, I'm going to go get my teeth. It's one thing to nibble an ear when you're young and energetic and nibbling is easy. But it's another thing to nibble an ear when the ear doesn't hear so well anymore and it has a hearing aid there and the air is filled with the scent of Bengay and you got to get your teeth first. Sometimes it's not easy, even the good things. So when you're in the desert, will you learn to be patient? And will you learn to trust God? And will you learn to take one day at a time? Will you persist in prayer when you'd rather not? Will you be patient with people who drive you crazy? You have to learn patience in the desert or else go back to Egypt. Here's another desert training lesson. The desert is a place that makes you strong. The question we're always asking in the desert is why? You know, why am I here? Why did you lead me here, God? Why have you put me here? Why am I here? For Israel, the I-64 route would have taken them into a war zone with the Philistines. And God could have defeated the Philistines, but the Israelites wouldn't have believed that yet. So God had to take some extra time to develop his people, which a direct route would not have accomplished. I really appreciate this line from John Ortberg. He says, God isn't nearly as concerned with where his people are going as he is with who they will be when they get there. That's a good line. His concern is not primarily about where I work or live or what relationships I get into, but who am I becoming? For 400 years, Israel had been slaves, and they thought of themselves as slaves. They didn't think of themselves as saints, as strong people led by a mighty God. Ortberg goes on to say, it took one night to get Israel out of Egypt, but it took 40 years to get Egypt out of Israel. It's so easy to trust God in the land of milk and honey. Your prayers are answered. Your problems are working out. You just got a promotion. The boss loves you. The orthodontist just gave you a half-price deal, and faith is not hard. But in the desert, it's another story. And God's people are pretty familiar with the desert. Joseph was sold into slavery, and the only thing that made it to the promised land were his bones. David is anointed king of Israel, but he goes a roundabout way to the throne. At one point, he's hiding out in caves, trying to stay alive as a homeless fugitive. Daniel, and he grew strong on a long route, which traveled right through a lion's den. And you know this principle is true. When have you learned your most valuable lessons? When have you had spiritual growth spurts? When you've been led in a way you don't want to go, and you don't know where you're going to end up. When in the middle of pain and loneliness, you can stand up and say, God has not left me. He has not let go of me. A few years ago, I was talking to a mentor of mine who was dealing with a pretty serious case of lung cancer. And in fact, he had one lung removed and been through a lot of treatment. And as I listened to him tell me about his journey that he'd been on, he claimed the words of a Christian song as his anthem. He said, through the entire journey, receiving the diagnosis, enduring the surgery, experiencing their treatments, he said, never once have I ever walked alone. And I think about him every time I hear that song, and his thankfulness and his awareness reminds me of what's true. When you can give thanks in the desert, you grow very strong. When you're on a desert journey and you say, I will not go back to Egypt no matter what happens, I'm going to follow Jesus, then you're growing deep roots of faith. In the desert, you learn to trust God, and that experience makes you strong. You don't think God has forgotten about you or that he doesn't care. He cares a great deal, more than you'll ever know, and he wants you to be strong. Some of you in here would like to be in a relationship, looking for a life partner, and that's a good thing. But you may feel like you're on a roundabout journey in this search, and you've been waiting for Mr. Right or Mrs. Right, and you've been waiting a long time, and all your friends are engaged or even married or at least dating, and you're beginning to think Mr. Right or Mrs. Right isn't coming, that Mr. and Mrs. Right live in France, the place you're not likely to visit. And you're thinking, maybe I should settle for Mr. Not So Terribly Wrong. And you're single, and you feel like you're in a desert. Will you say, wherever this journey takes me, I will follow Jesus. I will not get entangled in a serious relationship with someone who's not a Christ follower. I will not get sexually involved with a person to whom I'm not married, no matter how great the pressure may become. And if I've already done that, I'll stop, even today. If you do follow Jesus in whatever desert you're stranded in, and if you don't give up, you'll discover that God is making you very strong. Finally, the desert is a place where you learn to love God for who he is and not just for the milk and honey that he gives you. There's a scene that's kind of common if you go into, you know, an arcade or a Chuck E. Cheese or a place like that. The little boy standing in front of one of those claw machines, you know, with a bunch of really valuable merchandise inside, a baseball or a stuffed animal or maybe a video game or something with a $20 bill wrapped around it. And if you drop the claw at just the right moment, you collect these great toys. You know what I'm talking about, that little arcade thing. And do you know how easy it is to get one of those toys out of there? I mean, I don't remember ever seeing anyone win except Sid on Toy Story. That's the only one. This little boy camps out in front of that machine and he nearly worships it and he says sweet things and he gives all he has until his pockets are empty, but the machine doesn't give him any toys. And when no toys come out and all the money's gone, does he still love that machine? See, the desert is a place where no toys are coming out of the machine. At least not the toys you're wanting. The manna and quail and fire and cloud and water, they don't count. I don't get the promotion. I don't get the success. I don't get the house or even the health I want. And then I find out. Then I find out, do I really love God? Do I love him for who he is? Or do I just love him for the toys? Do I love God because he's my creator and because he's holy and his love is beyond all imagination? And we seriously despise being used in relationships, but do we ever use God for what he can give us? In the desert, as you learn patience and as you grow stronger and as you develop a pure love for God, you'll lose a lot of what you've held on to. You may even feel like you've lost everything. And then you'll find God. And you'll realize he was never far from you on this desert journey. And you'll discover that he will be enough for you. God is in the desert while we're on our long and arid journey. He's a God who goes to a throne, not by a straight route, but by way of a cross. And he says to you and to me, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. So stay faithful in the desert. Stay faithful in my roundabout ways, because a day is coming when every valley shall be raised up and every mountain be made low. The rough shall become level and the rugged places become a plain. In other words, there'll be a direct path to the promised land. No more roundabout ways. No more deserts. And those who remain faithful in their deserts will meet God and rejoice. So this morning, I invite you to view your deserts as places and times where valuable training occurs. Training you will not get anywhere else. Training which is preparing you for the journey that God has planned for you. I doubt if we'll ever ask God to send us to the desert. The desert will not likely be a place we long to camp. But when we're there, we can still be faithful. And we can be aware of what we might learn. And we could be assured that we're never alone. Let's stand and sing. But where's Greg?